to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. A weekly podcast where the discussion is about the most recent horror and genre films. Intelligent talk on a genre that deserves intelligence. A conversation between co-hosts discussing not only the film, but also the connotation that the directors and screenwriters are trying to articulate. If you want more than a review, listen to Dark Discussions.
And speaking of perception, there's just one more scene I want to talk about, which is after Caleb discovers that Kyoto's a robot, Kyoto kind of peels off her skin, showing him what's underneath.
Now, wait a minute. I know where you're going with this, but tell me you weren't already thinking this 15 minutes earlier in the film. Exactly what he's thinking at that moment.
Which is he's a robot, too.
Oh, I considered the possibility.
Right, and that's what I like, is the fact that the writers were smart enough to know that this is what the audience would be thinking.
We've all seen Blade Runner.
Right. Exactly.
www.darkdiscussions.com, wherever podcasts are found.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how's it going, sir?
It's going well.
Excellent. And state of New York?
Hey, this is Mike.
How are
you? I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And in the state of Massachusetts? In the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, hey, how's it going?
I'm doing well.
And a surprise person named Christy from Connecticut?
Yes, actually, I'm coming to you live from the tornado zone.
Yeah, now explain what happened in this macro burst thing. What the heck happened?
There, I will be very brief. Basically, Danbury got hit. Danbury, Southbury, Northern Fairfield County, a town next to me called Brookfield, got hit with a very intense rash of freak storm cells. They generated a few tornadoes, F1s, and a couple of things called macro bursts, which can result in twisting winds of up to a couple of 100 miles an hour. I think they said that the one that might have hit my house was like 110 or 120 miles an hour. Basically, my husband was home. He saw the tornado literally coming across our property toward the house. Didn't have time to get in the basement. Screamed tornado, ducked under the kitchen table, and said what he saw was all of my porch furniture. Now, I have very heavy porch furniture. And as well as my big gas grill lift up, like the hands of God were lifting them up off the porch and spin them around and flung them. We have about 35 to 40 trees down on our property. A tree was javelined right through my second floor. My bedroom is destroyed. My husband's car was totaled, smashed like a pancake. And it turns out that the tree that actually hit my house was not even like next to my house. It was from like across the street.
Holy
yeah. So yeah. So the short version of that is strong wind make house go boom.
Yes. Yeah.
Right.
So it's been a little crappy here. We finally were able to get an assessor here on Sunday. I went and picked new carpet, new stuff today for my room and whatever. And my bathroom's going to have to be done too, because the wall in my bathroom is gone. So that's what happened to me. And nobody got hurt. And my husband bought the Dukes of Hazzard truck of his dreams that he's always wanted. So... to replace the car. It's a farm truck. It's all rusted. It's totally sexy. I love it. And, it's not too bad. I can't lie and say that this has not been a very full upsetting couple of weeks. But it's, once you're coming out on the other side and you start cleaning things up and you realize that you're going to get that new carpet you always wanted, it kind of takes the sting out of it. So anyway, that's why I have been gone, folks. So I apologize.
It's just glad you're okay. That's the most important part.
Well, yeah, and we also lost internet. We didn't have internet here for almost 2 weeks. I just got my landline phone back yesterday. And we are not alone. And believe me, there are people that are much worse off here. I know friends where their houses are just literally gone. Like, gone. Like, there is no more house. It's just smashed.
Well, the good news is that this doesn't happen in Connecticut all the time like it does in the Tornado Alley.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it just should never happen in Connecticut. I said, gee, you know, I was kind of like, I really don't want to live in Connecticut anymore. I haven't my whole life pretty much. And I'm like, but, you know, at least we don't get really bad freaky weather. Okay, well, now that's gone. So if I'm going to go live at risk of like in being in a tornado or some other terrible thing, then I want to go live where it's cool and it's worth the risk living there.
Hawaii!
Yes, exactly. Give me a volcano in my backyard, people. I live in Hawaii. All right.
I remember I had a friend in my writing group who originally was trying to get a job testing out vacation sites prior to the eruption. So it was kind of lucky that she didn't get the that job because, you know, that shit's still going on.
It's going to be going on for a while, and my heart absolutely goes out to those people.
I know.
They are losing everything. Yeah. And the islands, it's going to be very severe because the island's economy is going to start crashing. It already is. Their vacation cancellations, from what I understand, are extremely high. You know, you're talking about a major economic disaster, as well as people losing their livelihoods and their homes. And it's extremely sad.
It is. So. At the same time, they chose to live on a volcano. So,
yes. Well, I mean, if I chose to live on a volcano, I would live with that at risk. And what's interesting is when you see these people like talking about it, like on the news, they're like, yeah, well, I knew this was going to happen someday. Like, they seem so calm about it. And I'm just like, oh my God, I would be losing my mind. I didn't even lose very much, really. And I was losing my mind. So I don't know how, these people are coping, and my thoughts go out to them.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, very well, very well. So that's good. Chrissy is safe and sound and is back with us, which is a great thing. Let's see a few things first. I sent out the emails to our Patreon supporters to give us their May picks for a podcast potential. So basically, if you donate to patreon.com/darkdiscussions for every $5, you donate, you get to add each month a film to our queue, and then we randomly pick at the end of the quarter from that list one of the films, and we will do an episode on that. So, folks, try to get those in soon. Mike, I know you're a big fan of this show, Sons of Anarchy. There was a passing. Do you know about this?
The only thing I know is that I saw. That's recent?
Yeah, actor Alan O'Neill found dead at 47 today.
No, I have no idea what this is.
Yeah, so I don't know. I was going to ask you if you remembered the character, because I honestly haven't seen the show now for 3 or 4 years, so I forgot. But
I haven't seen it since probably we've done the episode on the final season.
So folks who are interested in reading about that, just search for Alan O'Neill, Sons of Anarchy on Google, or you can go to Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, and I've put a link.
I think he played, I'm not positive, I think he played one of the members of the Irish gang.
Oh, yeah, I think you may be right there, Mike. Yeah, yeah, that's right. So one of the later seasons. Yeah, so that's an unfortunate passing there. Let's see. I joined Instagram myself, not as the podcast, but just as myself.
Phil, are you sure you're not a teenage girl?
Well, I only have linked. Well, the reason I did it was because Dustin Watson of Horror Corner did it, and so I said, I might as well try it. So I know my brother does it and a few other people, but I did it. So far, I have no idea what it's for, or what to do, except that I linked to Sophie Turner and Sophie Turner's restaurant review.
Of course you did.
And that's all I've done at this point.
And she's already notified the police.
Every move you make.
Let's see what else. I'll be following her on Instagram. Mike, you gonna say something?
Yeah, I did want to mention if we're going through bad things happening to people. No, this was this unfortunately is relatively serious. Listening to the podcast, I'll be going down to, and maybe Phil will be going down to Scares at Care Weekend at the beginning of August, and the author and podcast track of that convention are run by author Brian Keene. Brian Keene, and he had actually asked us to the Dark Discussions would be the warm-up show for his own podcast Friday night. He contacted me directly and said he kind of wanted a heavy hitter for Friday night and asked if we would do it, which I thought was weird and humbling and made me question.
And awesome. That's awesome.
It made me fear that if we're the heavy hitters, I can't imagine what else is there. But, well, I do know who else is there. Will be Archivist Bed on Sexy Witches with Elizabeth Catherine Gray.
But, Mike, we are cool. Rondo Award winners. I mean, Rondo...
Or nominees. But anyway, so he was he lives in Pennsylvania, out in the middle of the rural area, more affectionately known as the Sticks. And he was clearing out brush, burning brush outside his house, and the wind shifted direction, and he got severe burns on his hands and on his face. Second and third degree burns. And so he's in the hospital right now. He is enjoying the medication. There has been a GoFundMe set up because he does not have insurance because he is a full-time author. And while he does very well as an author and is able to make a living as an author, he just was playing the odds and it didn't work out so well. They have raised a good amount of money, but... I can't imagine that this treatment long-term and hospitalization is going to be cheap. So if anyone happens to be a fan of his work, the ways you can help contribute, if you want, you can go to the GoFundMe page. You can go to either his page on Facebook. You could go to Scares the Care Weekend on Facebook. You could go straight to the website GoFundMe.com and type in Brian Keene. That's BRIANKEENE. Or the other thing you do is go to any one of your various booksellers online that would carry his books, like Amazon. I'm not sure who his current publisher is, and buy some of his books. You get money that way if you want to contribute.
So, how did you find out what actually happened? Because obviously, we all knew about it, but we didn't know the details.
It's from piecing it together on the ScareCon website. Facebook page and being friends with a lot of people on that group. I've gotten to be friends with Mike Lombardo, who's made the movie I'm Dreaming of a White Doomsday. And he's sort
of... So you heard it through that website
through that page. Through that page, right. And Lombardo's basically become Brian's adopted son. And understand that this is a guy who last year did a 24-hour podcast marathon. He is not a young man, and he raised $10,000 for Scares the Care, and this year he did it again to raise $20,000. And, of course, part of the irony is that one of the things they raise money for is to help raise burn money victims. For burn victims. So, and now he is one himself. So doing rather well in the fundraiser, I will say that. I don't think it's going to be close to covering what his final bill is going to be.
All right, very good. All those places, you gave the links, and they're very easy to find. Worst case scenario is you just buy his books on Amazon and he gets a percentage, as we all know.
And he has always, I can't speak for anybody else, he has always been very good and generous to me in his time talking to me and how he's and many of the other people that I've seen attending that convention. So whatever little bit I can do to contribute to help him out, I thought I would mention it.
All right. Very good. Excellent. Excellent. I'm glad you did. Let's see. I don't think I got anything else of note. Anybody else get anything they wanted to bring up?
Not right now.
All right. So before we, bring on a special guest, Eric. What's the film we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be discussing the award-winning film, The Lurking Man.
choices. How can you just stand there and listen?
Maybe this will help instead. Take the edge off. It wasn't your fault. It was an accident.
You are adapting to your new form. The doctors are delaying this on the other side as they needlessly try to save your life.
You're drunk! But I am sick and tired of you flaking on our son.
I want Bo to have his mother.
I want that too.
Then pull it together!
Why do you hide in the dark?
Hide? The darkness is where I dwell.
I'm ready to be your mother.
Resist what it is telling you to do.
Well, your sessions seem to be working wonders.
My sessions? I'm not sure I understand.
With Kaylee?
I'm afraid I haven't seen Kaylee since. I can check my calendar, but since the last time the two of you were in together.
Death has come upon your son. I come for it.
What are you doing here?
I care about them too, Wilson.
Please, he's been through so much already.
Tell me. Is my son okay?
Hold on a second, Kaylee. Enjoying purgatory?
This is your last chance.
You insolent fool! You do not dictate terms!
That's right. The Lurking Man. Technically, it's a 2017 film, but it was really released everywhere in 2018. 2017 festival circuits. It's directed by a woman named Jen Page. Written by Maritza Brixisak.
Nice try.
Maritza.
Oh my God, Phil.
Maritza Brixisak. Yeah,
there you go. Second try was much better.
Yeah, hey, we'll put it this way. This is an Eastern European name. They use Z's and J's and all these other weird letters everywhere in their alphabet.
So. I'm not saying I could do better. I'm just laughing at you.
Gotcha. Hey, I was able to see Polly Masiak's name, and I got that.
That's
one right.
You were.
That's right. Keith Rommel also was the co-writer of it, and he's actually the writer of the novel that this is based off of, called The Lurking Man. The film stars a number of folk, mostly folks I've never heard of, though I have heard of one. Believe it or not, the co-screenwriter, Maritza Brixisak, is the lead of the film. And then we have other folks in the film. Jensen Ramirez plays the son. Frank Krueger plays the ex-husband in the film. Dorian Gregory plays the neighbor. And there's a few other folk. But also one person of note is actually, I believe, was won awards for his performance in the film is a man named Daniel Lynch, who I think may be on the podcast.
I'm here. I've been listening to all of you.
Uh-oh, secretly. We're in trouble now.
Secretly. And Phil, you got it right. It's Maritza Brixisak. You pronounced it perfectly the last two times.
Good. That is Phil's superpower, is taking names that are to Americans exotic and pronouncing them correctly.
Okay, and before we go any further, I want to start by saying that I am, like, so excited and so honored and so pleased that you guys have invited me back to talk with you. I can't tell you how many hours of pleasure I get from listening to you discuss various movies, discuss Westworld, Game of Thrones. I spend a lot of time listening to you all. I feel like you're all really in my bedroom, which is probably not right. Come think of it.
But
And that, ladies and gentlemen, that is called acting. That's acting. I believed every word of it.
It's such a pleasure to be here. You guys bring so much joy to my life. You helped me find wonderful films. I love listening to the way you intelligently discuss genre films.
Are you sure you're listening to our podcast?
Oh, wait. Is this Bloody Bits?
No.
Oh, that was cold.
I think you're looking for Horror Corridor. Thank you, Dan. We appreciate it. And I think we're just as excited to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I'm super psyched.
Yeah. A couple of things. One thing that Dan has recently done that I wanted to ask him about, and then explain how we began, which would be the second thing. And then we'll do a roundtable of what we thought of the film and how we heard of it. And then we'll start talking about the film with Dan.
Sounds awesome.
All right, so Dan, the first thing I wanted to ask you was you actually wrote a foreword to a book that and Christy Peterson Scootover stories in?
I did. I actually did. It's a boy, and if I had it right in front of me, I could even tell you the name of it. Invocations?
That's right, yeah.
It is a marvelous collection of stories about demonology and about summonings. I was invited by a very handsome gentleman to participate, to write a foreword to it. It was really exciting to me because I'd never really written, and I'm just not a published author by any means, unlike many of you. So to be honored to those wonderful stories and then to write about them and write about my experience with horror stories was a treat. And so, yes, I did write the foreword to that fantastic anthology.
Excellent. Yeah. And you can find that on Amazon.com where it's Barnes & Noble, too, and whatnot. So it's a good anthology. It has some good names in it. MJ Preston, Gregory Norris, among others. And Patrick Lacey's in it. So it's a good collection of.
It is. And there are some wonderful stories in there. Just absolutely wonderful. And Christie's included.
I stand corrected. Phil's power is to invite guests onto his program to promote his own material.
And that is a good superpower.
That is a good superpower.
Speaking of promotion, I think that's the reason why we met you, Dan, was somehow you found our podcast. I think what it was is I posted the episode for the movie Circle on Twitter.
That's correct.
And then I did the pound sign or whatever they call it, hashtag.
They call it a hashtag, so yeah.
Yeah. Whenever I call it a pound sign, my daughter looks at me very funny.
Well, yeah. I still call it a pound sign because pound is easier to say than hashtag, so whatever.
Chrissy, get with it, it's hashtag.
No. Word economy over coolness the day of the year, but that's okay.
So yeah,
hashtag get with it.
That's right, Philip. You tweeted the episode of Circle, and it caught my eye because I was, you know, super excited about kind of what the world thought of the movie. Having, you know, as an actor, obviously you're fairly insulated unless you're in a, you know, huge popular film. You're fairly insulated from response about, you know, other than reviewers, et cetera. So it was really cool to spot that and to listen in. And, you know, when you go to a podcast or something like that about a film, you go in kind of, you know, warily, with you know, pinches of salt. As I was listening to your folks' podcast about Circle, I was so impressed with, as I said earlier, the intelligence, the humor, and the fact that you called me a whiny bastard. I'm still not over that, but we can move on from that.
You know, oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, your character.
You keep saying that, but I feel like you meant me. It was
okay,
a personal attack.
I don't remember. Do you remember which one of us called you a whiny bastard?
I think.
Yeah,
right. Woohoo!
Again, not that I'm holding a grudge or remembering. Just a guess.
So if you ever make your own films, it should be Whiny Bastard Productions.
Oh, yes, definitely. And I'll go B. They'll think I'm Warner Brothers when they look behind. Yeah, that one bastard.
There you go.
I like it very much. So anyway, so I saw that and I tweeted back to you guys because I was so pleased with the way you attacked the way you discussed the film, because you certainly didn't attack it. You had very, very nice things to say about it. And so I, you know, and then I wrote and Philip invited me to come play with you. Or Eric, I can't remember. Which one of you invited me to play?
It was probably Phil. He's usually... Yeah.
I think I responded to you right after that. And then I spoke with Eric and Mike and everybody to see if, hey, you want to invite this guy named Dan Lynch, the guy that wore the sweater? Sweater vest, I guess.
Sweater vest guy.
Yeah. Well, see, that's not – because I asked, well, who was it? I think he said something – I could be getting the adjective
wrong. Yeah,
you thought
it was someone else originally.
Because he's like, he's the guy who played the rich asshole. I was like, oh, okay. I had a different – I was talking about the
lawyer, right?
The lawyer, right? I was thinking it was the lawyer because we said the asshole. So the good news is when someone, whether it was asshole or bastard or prick or whatever we used to describe you, I didn't immediately think of you. Just you know.
And then when you realized it was me, you said no, and it was too late.
That was it.
The damage was done.
Yeah, but that movie was a bad experience for me because
I remember,
I could have saw it for free. On Netflix, and that pissed me off.
Well, that was the beginning of a gold mine for the rest of us, and Phil purchasing films that soon thereafter became free for the rest of us. So thank you, Phil.
Yes,
thank you. You've saved me so much money. I can't thank you enough.
We all have our burdens to bear, Phil.
Phil is going to be the Netflix version of the Geico Gecko.
All right. So tonight we're going to be talking about The Lurking Man, starring our special guest Daniel Lynch. According to the wiki on IMDb, it says, Callahan is an abusive alcoholic mother. She dies. She is offered a chance at redemption if she accepts death's offer. Now, Mr. Lynch, if you've unmuted, can you tell us if that is an accurate synopsis of the movie or not?
It is a relatively accurate synopsis, except her name is pronounced Kayleen.
Kayleen, sorry.
Yeah, I don't care. No, I mean, I care.
It's not his character.
It's not my character. You just get my fucking character right.
Right. Well, and speaking of that, I'd like to ask you about a bit of trivia here on IMDb.
Okay.
It says, during the early stages of development, quote, Sariel had been thought of being mostly a voiceover role. When, quote, Daniel Lynch auditioned, he was so animated that the character was reworked to include him in most all of his scenes with Kayleen. He became a figure dwelling in the shadows. So I guess my real question here is, since they have your name in quotes, is Daniel Lynch actually your name?
Ah, excellent question. No. No, it is.
Oh, imposter! Oh my God, I feel betrayed.
Yes, it is my actual name, and yeah, that is absolutely true. As a matter of fact, both Jen Page, the director, and Maritza Brickasack, the producer and star of the film, talked to me that, afterwards. They very now, mind you, they were auditioning actors for it, but they really didn't tell the actors really all they were looking for. Was a voiceover actor. They didn't want to kind of give that up to make the actors not want to show up. But you know, I read the script. I found out that it was a novel. I went back and I read the novel before the audition. I got asked my agent to get me an audition. I loved the sides, which you know is it's the audition piece that you're going to work with from you know a scene from the movie or not, depending on how they prepare the sides. Sometimes they do trick sides that are never going to be in the movie. Sometimes they do sides they think are going to be in the movie, blah, blah, blah. So anyway, so I prepared the sides. I went there. I thought, this is a really interesting character. And I auditioned, and then they sent me back out of the room. Very similar to Seven. They sent me out of the room with another script, you know, and just ice cold said, can you just do something with this? Because we're interested. And I went, oh, okay, you know. Went out, took about, you know, 5-10 minutes to kind of look over the text and work on a little. Went back in and had so much fun with that text and with the actress who they had me reading with, who was a wonderful, very present actress, not in the film, just their reader. But I had so much fun working with her, and she was, and you know, one of the things you do in a, by the way, if I'm rambling on too much, you'll stop me, right?
We wouldn't have invited you on the show if we didn't want to listen to you talk.
Okay, well, because I do ramble. Speaking of which, back in 19... No. The actress, one of the things you do as an actor, if you're any kind of a decent professional, is you say to the person you're reading with, or the actress or actor you're reading with, is it okay if I, you know, do this or touch you here or do any of these, you know, have some physicality here? And if they say no, then you don't. And then this actress was, yeah, of course. And so I just had so much fun. It was this particular set of sides was almost verbatim what they used in the film for when Serial goes to find the demon inside her. Are we allowed to give out spoilers? Is it too soon?
No, that's okay. I mean, I think most of our listeners know we spoil it anyway.
Yeah, we're a spoilerific podcast, so if anybody is listening to this without having seen The Lurking Man, first of all, what are you waiting for? Go watch the movie. And second of all, we will be spoiling the movie. So if you're interested in it, which you should be, and want to avoid spoilers, just put this on pause until you've seen the movie.
And thank you.
Then pick it up from here.
Thank you. And I will do my best not to spoil too much. But yeah, if you do want to see the movie, it's available on Amazon. It's not on Amazon Prime, unfortunately. So you got to pay, I don't know, $3-4, whatever it is for rental. It's available on Vimeo. I think those are the only two places right now it's currently available, but I think it'll have a wider release later. So anyway, so I was working on that scene with this actress, and I was just having so much fun, and I just really enjoying who I kind of found this guy to be. And indeed, they told me later, you know, we were so on such a tight budget. We just wanted to do this really easy, just get a voiceover actor and have the Lurking Man never seen. But we just loved what you were doing physically and the way you were manifesting this guy that we had to have you. So,
well, and that actually was a perfect lead into a question I had about that whole situation, given that they hadn't planned on having you appear on screen initially. Did they have to make any budgetary considerations for, because you're actually in quite a bit of costume and makeup in this role. Did they have to rework to accommodate that?
They did indeed. And that's a great question. It was, they had to definitely rewrite a lot of stuff, and they had to make, but you know, Maritza was the primary producer, the executive producer on this, along with Frank Krueger, who played her husband, her ex-husband, Wilson, was also a producer, but she was the primary. And so she had it was her budget. And Jen was, you know, respectful of that, but she said, you know, the makeup has to be right. Now, step back. The costume was the marvelous work of Alicia Silver and Zach Silverstein. He created the wings and some of the special effects, which I want to talk about later. I can't remember the name of the lead makeup artist right now. I mean, the lead costumer. Anyway, she was wonderful. But so the costume was kind of already sort of in place once they decided we're going to have an actual actor do it. They had to spend some money. They had to spend some money to make the wings. Maritza had to put that up. And then when we had makeup tests, they had to bring me in twice, actually, because the first time the fantastic makeup crew, Brenna Hockdale, Alex Galvez, Megan Longmire, all just wonderful folks. The first makeup session was with just Brenna, I think. And they tried some prosthetics and some things and some stuff. They tried to go with some just different kind of color schemes and makeup. And it was interesting, but it just didn't work, you know? And so, you know, Jen said, you know, looked at the pictures of it, and Maritza, and she said, this isn't going to work. We've got to do it again. We got to go back. We got to try something more, something different. So we went back a second time for a makeup test. I spent, gosh, hours in the chair while we tried different looks. And I think it was the third makeup test or the end of the second makeup test when we finally kind of found that look with the raised eyebrows and the cheekbones. And the sunken eyes that go ahead.
I was going to ask you, you look very gaunt. I was going to ask you if that was a makeup trick or if you lost a bunch of weight before this movie was shot.
I'm not a firm believer in changing your physicality, your who you are physically to just take on a role. I'm not like a Christian Bale.
Fair enough.
I think,
you don't really like to do method acting.
I'm not a method actor. There are aspects of method acting that I use. Here's another discussion rambling on. There are basically, in my opinion, there are two different types of actors, just basically, real basic truth. There are outside-in actors and inside-out actors. Method is an inside-out, an example of an inside-out actor, whereas Gortowski or Michael Chekhov are examples of in acting. And I am an outside-in actor. I find pieces of physicality, how I look in a costume and how I physically manifest this character. I use things from Michael Chekhov called psychological gestures, things like that that I find physically first as I'm working on the text, and then allow them to kind of seep into who I am, who the personality is. So I'm definitely an outside in, not an inside out.
So you would not be like Leonardo DiCaprio, who literally starved himself and put
that
himself
is correct.
To doing the Revenant.
Nor the little what's his name? Oh my God,
Robert De Niro.
Well, De Niro, who put on all that weight for Raging Bull, which is an incredible role, obviously.
And the Untouchables.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, absolutely.
And Val Kilmer did it for The Doors.
He did indeed. And yeah, poor Val is having some some. I hope it's not related to that.
I do. I did have a question kind of related to your method a little bit, Dan,
sure.
And I know we're not discussing the film as really yet, but the Angel of Death to me, I don't want to say it's a common character or like a trope, because that would imply that I'm saying that it's, cliched, and that's not what I mean. The Angel of Death is such a classic iconic character. It's a character that has made an appearance in folklore, in classical literature, in medieval literature, in just about every culture. There is some version of an Angel of Death going back probably as far as the beginning of time. So this is really part of our humanity, if you will. So when you were working with this character, my question is, did you look at some of these older interpretations of this type of character? What were your specific influences? Did you have any at all? And what did you sort of do to give him a little bit of a different spin to make him different? Because I do think he was a very different interpretation from what I've ever seen before.
I very, very much agree and appreciate that. I take that as a compliment indeed. I have to be honest, I didn't go to a lot of sources. I did do some internet research because I was the manifestations of the Angel of Death, and specifically about Serio, who is indeed one of the seven archangels, and is one of the... he's sometimes called Serial, he's sometimes called Uriel, but he is an angel of death. He is one of the archangels of power. Now, where I started, to kind of take a step back, and actually I'm going to take even three steps back. Keith Rummel, who wrote The Lurking Man, written a series. This is the second in a series of books called the Thanatology series.
Oh, cool.
Right. Yeah, I presume you guys didn't know. Yeah. So it is. So he's. The second, the first one is a book called The Cursed Man, and it was also turned into a film directed by the really fantastic director Jim Perry, and starring some actors who you may recognize. I don't have their names in front of me right now. I do have a computer, but I'm not going to look it up. The Cursed Man was the first film, and then Maritza reached out to Keith, read the book, was connected with The Cursed Man, asked Keith was anybody looking to do anything with the next book, which was The Lurking Man, got the rights to it, worked with Keith on how to writing the screenplay. They submitted to festivals, won. So I went back and I read. Now, there are, four or five books now, I think, in the Thanatology series. The third one is called The Sinful Man, and I want to talk a little bit later. The fourth one is called Silent Woman, and I think the last one is called The Book of Serial, I think. But the So I read The Lurking Man. It obviously cover to cover right away as soon as I had been cast. I glanced at it before I did the edition, but I read it cover to cover. And Keith is truly, he did the research. He really looked into it. If you look at the names of the characters and you go back research on him, you'll see that he was very thorough in his research about biblical connections to the Sariel and the Angel of Death and what the Angel of Death is and what the Archangels of Power are. So he did his work. So I kind of, and this character that he wrote, this, the thing I loved about Sariel when I read the book and then what I tried to bring to the script and what I thought was a good part of the script is that it's a sympathetic character. He's a character of power, but he's also, big spoiler alert on this one, big spoiler alert on this one. He's also somebody who has done this for too long, who's done this for thousands and thousands of years and doesn't want to do it anymore, whose body has been ravaged by this, by doing this, who started as this gaunt, skeletal looking image, but started as a human being and has done this for thousands and thousands and thousands of years and doesn't want to do it anymore. So I love that about
him. Yeah, and I got that sense from the character by the way whenever he tries to spread his wings, it looks painful to do so. It's very, very
okay.
Well, in a way that when we see an angel spread its wings in mythology, it's a very powerful and very divine
majestic
sight. Majestic.
And very majestic, yeah. This didn't have that feel to it at all. It was very interesting.
It's about flesh without feathers. It looks like it's trying to present lost glory of lost power and stuff like that. A frailty.
Yes. Yeah. I have an interesting story about the wings. We probably get into a little later, but I think I finished answering the question. Anyway, I recommend, if you haven't read them, I recommend that you read Keith's novels. They're easy to find, and they're just so good. He's such an interesting writer and such a great guy. So I immediately reached out to him, and he reached out to me, and we talked. And I'm very interested in working in his next novel, of his novel, The Silent Man. That's kind of in hiatus right now. It's out there. It's in limbo. The screenplay's been written. We're not sure where it's going at this point, but they know I'm very interested in playing one of the roles in that.
So going at, was I remember him saying he was one of the fallen angels?
He is. No, I don't think he says he's one of the fallen angels. My recollection is he says he's one of the seven archangels of power.
Okay. All right. So I might have just been misremembering from what I heard last night. So I really do. Do you know the name of the makeup artist? Because I really
do. Brenna.
What is that name?
Brenna Hockdale was the lead makeup artist, and Alex Galviz, G-A-L-V-I-Z, was her number one assistant. And then they brought in a third girl, Megan Longmire, who helped quite a bit too. But really, Brenna and Alex were the two main makeup artists. And what an amazing job, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was very. I think it was very subtle. In the face, where there were definitely some appliances attached, but they weren't like obvious. We weren't talking Tim Curry and Legend type appliances,
right?
And just accentuated certain features of your face and highlighted. And it was a very interesting technique. Of you were out of focus for most of the film.
Yes, and that was that's obviously part of Jen and Collier's Jen Page, the director, Collier Landry, the DP, the director of photography. Definitely a part of their concept was they still wanted to have that aspect of lurking, which was very clear in the novel that he's always kind of lurking around the outside, barely caught, barely visible. She's always trying to find you. What are you doing to me? Why am I here? What is this? So they definitely wanted to capture that. And I think they did them and the amazing, crew, obviously lighting crew, that space. Let's talk about locations. Obviously, the only work that I did in this film was in this one location, even though there were lots of, outside locations and home locations. That one space was in a warehouse out in East Los Angeles or Southeast Los Angeles, industrial complex, warehouse that had been turned into a quote-unquote film studio, but was really a bare-bones place. and to take, it had like metal roofs, and it had an alley right outside, and there were garbage trucks and delivery trucks making bangings and beeps.
Oh, and there were
people walking on the roof throughout the, and we shot in there for 5 days, and it was always a struggle. Was that Phil coming back?
I am back.
Hey, Phil. We went off without you, man.
That's right. Yes, that's all right. That's good. I'm glad you guys did.
So this location was very difficult, and I have to give huge credit to the sound team, the sound mixer, the sound, because what you don't hear, I don't think. I've watched the film a few times now, and I don't see anything that gives away any of the noise problems that we were constantly having to stop for.
No, I didn't pick up on that at all.
No. Yeah. No, it was an amazing job because that location was very difficult. Go ahead.
I was going to say, when I watched that, I was honestly on a stage at the time. I could not sense any idea that it was where you described it to be.
Oh, yeah. And again, what a brilliant job by the lighting crew, by Collier Landry, and by Jen Page, the director, in creating that illusion. I was just, when I saw the final cuts on it, I was just so impressed.
Now, if you're comfortable getting into spoiler territory,
haven't I already done that?
Well, yeah, but I'm getting into serious spoiler territory here. I do have some questions that maybe you can help with that aren't necessarily directly related to your character. But I found it interesting that Sariel is looking for you. You referenced looking for the demon in this woman.
Yes.
And I have not had the opportunity to read the book yet. So I was wondering if that is meant to be as literal as it appears to be, if it's an actual demon inhabiting a person or if it's symbolic.
I believe it is meant to be as literal as it seems, although I think it has. Keith's intention was to, you know, physically materialize demons, but really to use that only as a springboard to talk about our own internal demons, you know, the alcoholism.
Well, and that's why I was asking, because it certainly seems like that's the topic at hand.
But he meant, again, he used the demons that he, Orthon, Kaling, these are, he chose these names intentionally. They come from references about actual demons, and so it wasn't an accident. And he definitely, in the book, it's very clear that these are physical manifestations. She is actually possessed by a demon, or she allows herself to be possessed by a demon when she's a child by listening to the call of the demon rather than the call of the angel. But again, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Donald Duck with the devil on one shoulder and angel on the other, right?
Yeah, I was also wondering whether, you know, she got possessed by a demon because she did something bad, or she did something bad and therefore got opened herself up to possession. It was an interesting
it's a great question, and it's never answered. It's not answered.
It's a chicken and the egg thing, you know.
Yeah, exactly. How did she get the demon inside her? Do we all have demons and angels inside us? You know, and it's just who we choose to feed. You know.
Well, I had had some comments about that whole inner demon thing too, because I think
I knew you would, Christy.
Yeah. because it's my thing. I think, you know, this movie had so many interesting things to say about the nature of addiction, about what really is a demon. Inner demons can very often in the paranormal world, in the supernatural world, if you believe in a supernatural world, or even so much as in, it tends to make people more susceptible to things. I know I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but, you know, my husband, a cult specialist, likes to talk about, in terms of paranormal theory, that some houses are doors and some people are keys. Mm-hmm. And so the whole idea that people who are wounded or damaged in some way, now we were just discussing the chicken and the egg thing. it seemed like even before she had become, you know, opened herself up, her parents, it didn't seem like a very stable home environment even before that. So
I very much agree.
Yeah, so if she was already wounded or damaged, she was probably more susceptible to the calling of the negative and the bad choices, if you believe in that sort of thing.
I mean, look at the choice that her father makes. He finds out what he believes actually really happened to her. Look at the choice he makes to deal with that.
Right.
That's not a healthy choice.
No. Right, exactly. And
look at the choice that the mother makes. Mm-hmm. When her husband is put in jail appropriately for the murder he has committed. Major spoilers. And that's not a healthy choice.
No.
Obviously. So I agree with you.
I think part of the ingredient for the this gestation of this demon was fear. The very fact that she was already living in an environment that was unsettling to her. And that
Oh, go on. Continue, Evan. Yeah. I'll interject.
It was her fear that gave the doorway to the first tragedy, which was the murder of the Christmas tree grower.
I wrote a review for Cinema Knife Fight about this movie, and I thought the girl was just a sociopath because the way she, what she did as a kid, and how everything follows through throughout her life. I remember I was watching the news with a buddy of mine that was an ex-alcoholic, and it was a woman, a teacher, that was arrested for statutory rape, and then she said that, you know, alcoholism, or she drank or whatever, and it caused this problem. Ridiculous. And my buddy said, what do you mean? Alcoholism makes you do really terrible things. And I said, yeah, but how many people do you know out of the folks that you go to AA with are statutory rapists? And he said, none. And he says, you have a good point there. And the point is that the alcoholism is just a side effect, at least in this woman's case, I felt, just a bad person all in all. And she was using this almost as like a crutch for what she's done from the past. Because she wasn't an alcoholic when she was a kid. Again, I haven't read this material, as I assume you have, Dan. So maybe her childhood was effed up.
It's not discussed, Philip. It pretty much starts going, where the hell am I? And then this stuff is revealed to her by Sariel to get her clean.
Right.
Her soul clean, clean of all influences, so he can get his exchange.
And I totally think that, like I said, I think it was brilliantly executed that there were enough subtle clues in that opening scene. Like, we don't see her parents until after she does the thing with the tree, but you just get a sense that these are not great people. And children learn, you know, not only do they inherit through DNA, but they also learn, you know, one of the things that you have with, but they learn. If they see their parents doing narcissistic behaviors, they're going to do the same thing.
I didn't see that in this movie. So I don't think we had enough of the parents' background in her home life to determine whether or not her childhood was as effed up as your
No, I know. Philip, I actually hear both sides, and I kind of agree with both sides, but I do have to say, as I've already said earlier, and I just want to repeat again, clearly there are the way that these parents react to the situation is so indicative of who they would have been, who they always have been. And that certainly, I believe, is indicative of how she was raised and perhaps what made her.
The reason I don't know that's true. I mean, obviously, you read the backstory of it, Dan, so you're probably right. But when I watched it, since I just looked at what I saw, I saw a man that did a terrible thing, but he did the terrible thing because he thought his daughter was molested by a child molester, a scumbag, basically, even though it was a lie. She had lied the whole thing. So he snapped and did a murder of an innocent man because he thought his daughter had been basically desecrated by
a scumbag. But he didn't ask, did you do this? Is this true, what my daughter tells me?
I'm not disagreeing with you. Again, though, I mean, he could have been thinking, why do I even ask? because he's just going to lie to me anyway.
Like, well, yeah, but it's, and I'm also going to take one step back and remind you that when she starts to tell him about the problem, where they, when the wife tells him, oh, Kayleen, got a call from Mr. Hagen again, and the first thing the father does is he starts to take off his belt.
Right.
Yeah, that's a good point. Okay.
And, yeah. And he says that she's only saying whatever she's saying so she can avoid
exactly
trouble.
Yeah.
So he understands that she's not the most trustworthy person. He is impulsive. And we see this abusive relationship continue with her and her son later on. So, yeah, there is always, or not always, but there's often a connection between an abusive parent, their own childhood.
I was just going to say that the mother's side, because I only talked about the father, the mother, I just assume when you're that massively depressed, you know, some people just can't handle it better than others. And, you know, she became a drunk and then basically suicided, I guess. So,
oh, well, I know. And I think that's part of it, too. I think, you know, I think all of these things sort of work in consort when you're you can be your own worst enemy. Which is kind of also a comment that this movie is making. And so not only was Kayleen raised in a home that we can kind of get the subtle clues, like I said, it's very subtly, but it is brilliantly done, that her life as a parent wasn't great. So, I mean, as a child wasn't great. So she's already depressed about that. So then she is wounded, so she's susceptible and makes the wrong choice. Her parents both made the wrong choices because that is what she learned. She learned from watching her parents to make wrong choices. Then, just like you said, Phil, she grew up and this depression plus the oppression by this supernatural force that was in her made her feel worse. So she ran to the alcohol. So you're definitely correct in that. I think it's a perpetuating cycle. It's like, you know, I mean, alcohol is a right. So when you're depressed or you're stressed out, you go, oh, I'm going to have a drink to take the edge off. Okay, well, that's great, except that it's just going to make you more depressed when you come out of it, which makes you drink more. Right. And that's how these
part of the cycle.
Yep. And Dan says sipping his red wine, I think you're right.
That's okay. I did a bottle and a half of white last night.
The other thing I found really interesting was how the way that this kind of pain is literally nurtured symbolically, as we see that the demon is literally a mirror image of our main character, while her angel is just still a child, completely weak and helpless in comparison.
Oh, yeah, that was cool. I really liked that. I thought that was such a neat concept.
Yeah, I thought so, too.
I got to be honest. When I was watching this movie, for about the first 30 minutes, I was like, I'm not sure about this one. But then the way it all came together at the end, I was like, oh, that was pretty cool. I really enjoyed it. And I found myself wondering, and perhaps as the man behind the character, I find myself wondering how long Serial has wanted out. And whether he's to other people or whether he's just been waiting for the right set of circumstances where he has a bargaining chip.
The answer to that question is yes.
Okay.
No, seriously. Yes, it has. He's been doing this. He has been searching for a long time. As I mentioned, he's been doing this for millennia. He has been, I didn't, for myself as an actor, and I don't think they put an actual time frame in the book, I don't think they did, but for myself as an actor, I didn't choose a very specific, you know, 1,010 years. I know that he's been doing this for millennia, and for the last probably several millennia, he's doing more and more and more. Jaded and tired and sick, and his body is deteriorating more and more and more to the point where it became just such a desperate seek. And I think he said, and there's a hint of it in kind of one of the last with Hogan scene where the bargain is finally made clear and struck. It's very clear. Kayleen says, how many vessels have you looked for like this? How many times have you done it? How long will it be before you find another one? And that's from the book. And so it's very clear He's done this many times and it's never worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, you know, he's at that tip point where, and he's, you know, he's just desperately trying to make this one work.
Now, does that she was possessed by a demon have anything to do with that situation, or was that purely coincidental? Could he have been the opposite to anybody?
I think the concept behind Keith's work and behind the screenplay is that he has to find someone who has been possessed by a demon and who has allowed that demon to rule them. And take over and become them and control them. That has to be to a certain degree. So that's why he says, I heard you louder than anyone I've ever heard before. Something along those lines. He has a line about your screams or your anger was the loudest ever. So he's drawn to that. He finds it that he knows Orthon is in there. He knows this is one of the demons are suggesting.
Made the offer to any alcoholic mother who crashed with her child and
only if Orthon's in them. Only if Orthon's in them.
Oh,
now, if I could go back for a second her childhood again.
I'm sorry. Okay, can you hold that thought? I want one kind of a general thing because we've kind of gone in depth and around and talked about all sorts of wonderful aspects. And I just want to say generally about the film for anyone who is interested and hasn't already been totally spoiled. It's not a horror film, which I think you probably have gotten from this conversation so far. It is a morality tale
with supernatural elements.
It is a morality tale, and it was so hard to describe when I was doing it and after it was complete and it was in the festivals to tell people because they see as Philip mentioned, the creepy makeup. And all my friends go, "Oh, I can't see that. That's horrible. I can't watch that." And I go, "No, it's not a horror film. It's a tale of redemption. It's a morality." So anyway, now go ahead, Philip.
All right, now let's go back to the her as a daughter when she was a little girl. We got to remember that the woman as an adult is probably in her late 40s, maybe early 50s. So when she was a kid, it was back in the day when the belt and spankings happened to everybody. So if we look at it that way, what was going to happen doesn't seem out of the ordinary. It only looks out of the ordinary if we look at it into today's terms. So I just wanted to bring that point up. Another reason why I didn't see anything wrong with her childhood, because again, as you said, even in the book, I guess it doesn't really go in depth to her childhood.
That's very true. Keith, it doesn't give you any hints about how or why the demon is in her. I happen to agree with Christy. She was susceptible.
They give us very little information about the parents. Yeah. And
that's true.
But when one of the pieces of information about the parents that they do give us is Dad taking off his belt, it's intended to, you have to assume that that's not a coincidence and that it's.
You should be right, Mike, but based off of the reason I still didn't catch it as a negative because of the time frame that it occurs is for the fact that the stuff that they show her doing to this guy's property is pretty bad because she's literally like destroying stuff.
Destroying his business.
His livelihood. Right. So when the father hears that she's done it for time, you can see him getting upset because not only is she's doing something terrible, but he has to pay for all that damage. And so it's like a double whammy.
But that's also how a lot of kids who are abused deal with things. They act out.
I know.
But again, we don't get enough to see that. I just assumed that she was a sociopath based off of her behavior, then to the point where she's an adult and she felt to be as a sociopath too. I guess you're right. You could look at it as in maybe she became the way she did as an adult because her childhood was terrible. But for whatever reason, I didn't see that. I just assumed that since there wasn't enough as a child to give us
a demon.
Well, that's, we find out later that a demon does take over her. But so anyway, it's just two ways to look at it because we don't get enough information.
Well, again, I think when they give you sparing information, they're trying to give you enough that you can draw the connections. I usually
maybe I'm overthinking then because I'm thinking, okay, this is from 1968 or 1974. These things happen. We see the terrible damage she's doing. I didn't think, that was her acting.
I don't think it was that far back.
And I don't know the time frame.
Yeah, right, right. But if you assume that she's 48 to 52, the actress and the co-screenwriter that played this actress, right, you figure that's the same age as us, Mike. So it would be 1976.
At 47, thank you. But
yeah, right. So well, soon you'll be 48 soon. So that's if you're 6 years old. You know, 1976, 1978, between that range was me to Chrissy and Mike, so and Eric. So you know, that's all. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And again, Phil, I do. The only other thing that I want to point out before we beat this one to death is that not only does his initial reaction is you know, here comes the belt and she's going to get another whipping, which implies in her fear of that, which causes her to make the next lie, to go the next level to the lie. But not only that, but his immediate reaction is not to go talk to the guy, not to find out the truth of the matter. It is to go there, grab the sickles, and slaughter the man in his doorway.
Right, right.
And that's not healthy.
That's a horrible thing. And yeah, I mean, none of us would do it, but again, none of us have had our daughter.
Yeah, I don't have sickles. I only have a machete.
Yeah, that's what I heard.
But none of us have had our daughter claim that they were sexually abused and raped by.
Yeah, that was true. That's true. Know. That would be a trigger for sure.
Yeah.
You are right.
So,
but he didn't go beat the crap out of him.
Again, though, if this guy raped your daughter, there's a chance that you could snap.
But you know, I understand that. But what is it about him that made him snap?
Well, it's like that movie that John Grisham, based on where Samuel L. Jackson plays a guy that his daughter gets raped. And
A Time to Kill,
yeah. And that guy goes and he does first-degree murder and kills the people that did it to his daughter. And again, you know, his daughter was raped and he got off.
But it's still, given that he has to go get the weapons and walk over there.
Move on, guys.
It's something about something in his personality. Anyhow,
I'm not disagreeing with you. I wouldn't do that, but Mike, I could see people if it was their daughter that was or son that was raped by some scumbag. Please. Yeah, sure.
All right. All right. So Dan,
yeah,
one thing I absolutely really liked is that I definitely agree with you that the moral tale. I definitely think it's more of a human drama than it is a horror element.
Yes.
Just because it's coming from a guy whose favorite film, an actual gateway movie, was also a moral tale, which was Pumpkinhead.
Yeah.
And the monster, because in fact, the small bits of horror elements don't come until like later in that film. And most part is focused in on the grief and the decisions made by the characters leading them up to the point where they become trapped in their own hell. Here, our main character in this film, making her decisions that land her in that role as well. Both characters making poor decisions and now have to try to redeem themselves, but also take on the role of a curse in a way.
Yes, I agree.
And hey, what is this other movie you're comparing it to?
Pumpkinhead.
Oh, okay, fair enough.
Because both characters have made choices that land them in a place where they now have to redeem themselves, but do not escape what they have to become in order to do that. And Harley becomes a demon at the end, and she becomes an angel in order to redeem herself. And I do love how that focuses on you know...
It's a perfect example, because again, it's a father who has a child that has been wronged.
Yes, but it's also the very fact that how our actions can destroy ourselves, and we wish we can go back to fixing them, but we can only forward it and try to atone if we are able to.
And this is why I enjoy coming onto these discussions, because you guys are just absolutely so interesting in how you approach. No, I mean it. I'm not joking.
And
very serious.
When I watched, my favorite parts were the scenes where it felt like with Sariel and our main character was almost like a stage play. It was like,
yeah.
You know, it could have been like, if you've actually seen this on a stage going on here, and it's wonderful because you can definitely, it's how we kind of incision our way deeper into the layers of this woman and learn more and more about her. And it's not as clear cut as we think, but we can see both sides of a story.
Yes, I agree.
There's no clear villain in this at all.
there isn't. Aside from the demon itself, but if we made this in symbolically, you know, everyone's trying to get by and human error.
Well, I don't know, Abe. I would agree that people are flawed, but if there is a villain, she is the villain because of...
Well, yeah, but she's not like your typical villain that you would see in a type of film.
Right, right. I would agree with that.
I would say she's more of almost like a tragic actor in one of Shakespearean plays.
Oh, she's a tragic figure for sure. Absolutely.
You know, yes, she is.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, and there is that moment at the end where her husband says, "I'm sorry you had such a hard life." That was a particularly moving moment that does reveal her really as a tragic figure. I'm sorry, Eric, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask everybody, do you think she was redeemed at the end of the movie?
I do not. I don't know. Let me tell you why. Because originally when I wrote my review for Cinema Knife Fight, I said that the reason she does it is more for selfish reasons rather than for heroic or redemption. And the reason I say that was because if she didn't do it, then she would be remembered as a scumbag mother because of the, you know, what happened. So I thought she did it so she would feel better about herself and her legacy rather than for any other reason.
Yeah, I got the sense more that she seemed beaten and defeated kind of at the end. I know that she kind of triumphed over her demon in a more literal sense, but that she's resigned to this, but she's going to make, I get the sense, it's not that she's triumphant or heroic, but that she's trying to make some good out of the mess that she's made.
Yeah.
You know, she's trying to erase some of the damage. That ends by getting some of the damage she's inflicted free from her son, you know, by getting him cured, by getting rid of some of the bad memories that he had. Mm-hmm. So I didn't get the fact that she did it for herself. I got the sense that she's burdened by the guilt of everything that she's seen and been forced to confront.
And I think that's right. Mm-hmm. And also remember that what she's taking on, it is no light sacrifice.
Right.
She's seen what it's done to this angel. She's seen that the path she's walking is a path of millennia and that it will destroy her body.
You're probably absolutely right. Yeah,
it's not an easy choice, and she has to make it of her own free will. That was kind of the key thing for Keith,
right?
In writing this, was that she all influences had to be removed. She had, as a human being, back to pure human being with no demons, no angels, nothing but humanity. She had to make a choice. He even says to her, "You're just doing this to be selfish. That's all." Exactly. Well, here we go once again, selfish choice. Yeah. And her response is no, I'm doing it because I don't want him to live with what I had to live with.
See, and that's, you're probably absolutely right, because most movies, obviously, especially a morality tale, would write it to be that way. Though I had already determined she was a sociopath from pretty much 10 minutes into
everybody had a sociopath.
I was going to say, Phil, you think everybody is a sociopath.
Well, most antagonists are, absolutely. And this one, I felt she was the entire film. And so I felt everything was for selfish reasons, even at the end, just like
after you found out there was an actual demon in her?
Well, as Dan just said, his character said, "You're still doing this for selfish reasons," even after the demon was thrown out.
But I think the way it's filmed, that she corrects him, I think it's that he's coming to a different conclusion.
And you're probably right, Mike. But when I watched it the first time and thought about it afterwards, I was just looking at it as her as a selfish person the entire time.
And you know, it's an equally reasonable point of view. It is. I mean, you can look at it like, in the end, she really did make a selfish choice. Although, as I say, the consequence of that choice is pretty...
Yeah, it's pretty awful, yeah.
Now, right, well, Dan, I mean...
Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I say the whole thing even gets back to, what was the old Indian story about, there's two wolves inside of us?
Yes.
There's basically, I don't remember the exact parable, but basically it's, you know, you have the good wolf fighting with the bad wolf inside of you forever, and the kid asks, well, how, which wolf wins? And he says, whichever one you feed. And right. That's why you get the bad demon inside of her, the devil on her shoulder is her twin, is her duplicate, because she's fed it, it's grown up with her, whereas the neglect held is the representation of the angel, because that's the one that she has not fed.
Also, Mike, I never thought about this, but Mike, I think you're absolutely right. I think that must have been something that was influencing Keith when he wrote this. It had to be, because you're absolutely right. That's right. Even like what I loved about the poster was the phrase, you know, the key phrase on the poster. What do you call that?
The tagline?
The tagline, stop feeding the monster within, you know. I thought that a wonderful tagline for that film.
Yeah, that is.
And you're right, it's the bad wolf and the good wolf, and it's whichever one feeds is the one that wins. You're absolutely right.
Right, and the my fear, I think Eric had mentioned, was at the beginning it felt like, oh my God, this is just going to be a tortured alcoholism metaphor.
Right.
And it's like, we're going to be in 90 minutes of how the demon is just a metaphor for alcoholism. When it's not, it does go beyond that. It does go a little bit.
I thought the alcoholism, even after that, was just a side effect of her fucked up life and wasn't an excuse for it.
I agree.
At least
it was the only extension of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to switch topics a little bit now, just because I want to ask this before I forget. Because Dan said he had a story about Serial's wings, and I was
I forgot about that. So the wings are amazing. They were developed by Zach Silverstein, who worked with Alicia Silverstein on costume and wardrobe and special effects. And the wings were originally designed to be worn. If you've been to the 13 Man website, and if not, you might want to go there because there's some fun bloopers and things like that on there, and some cut scenes, some deleted scenes that are kind of interesting and give a little bit more story that couldn't be fit into the 90 minutes we needed. But the wings, there's underneath the cloak that I wear, there's this massive backpack, which was very weighty on its own, but it gave me this wonderful hump-like appearance, so I loved it. And into this massive backpack, these wings were fitted, and they had a cord that went down inside the sleeves that I could pull the cords down and the wings would open and extend. That was the plan. However,
anytime you say that was the plan, we know there's going to be a problem.
However, the wings were very heavy. And the manipulation of those cords I'm a relatively strong guy. I play racquetball regularly. I'm in decent shape. But pulling with that backpack and the wings on, it was like 100-plus pounds on my back. And I'm not a spring chicken. We know this. And when you tried to pull those cords open, it was just like so obviously painful, and which is why I kind of laughed when I can't remember who it was. Was it you, Eric, who said, you know, or Abe? I can't remember.
It was me.
That said it was looked like, oh, so, you know, I could see the pain. Well, yes. So,
yes, it was painful.
But I'm glad it read as something else. But, and there were moments where I simply had to do that because of the way the thing was shot. But for the vast majority of the wing work, there was a guy or two guys standing behind me holding the wings and making them go up. And they weren't attached to my backpack. And for the vast majority of them, the original plan was I was to wear them at all times. Mm-hmm. And at various moments open them. And there was no way. There was simply no way. So originally I wasn't going to be sitting at all. I was going to be standing through the entire thing. And when they realized that there were some places where they wanted me to manipulate it, I had to be sitting. So the wings were, mind you, they're, as you can, as I think somebody said, they're gorgeous. They're amazing. It's a great effect. Mm-hmm. So they're so cool. And they were such a great design. And it's so what Keith imagined. And Stephen Cooney, Stephen Cooney is a horror artist, graphic designer, and his work is, if you get a chance to look him up, Cooney, Cooney, and Stephen with the PH. His work is amazing. Once in a while, I publish it, but his initial concept drawing of Serio is just it's just fantastic. So those wings certainly matched his concept. So they were an amazing thing. I just I wish I had been physically able to manipulate them like they wanted, but there it was.
Excellent, excellent. Thanks for the behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Oh, the fact was.
So wait. I'm going to go back to one thing also. We were talking about makeup. I got a little distracted on the makeup test, but I have to tell you, as I'm sure you're aware, every morning, 4 a.m., I was in that chair while that makeup was applied. Every morning for about 4 hours. Sometimes five.
Oh, geez.
It took a long time because the nails had to be, and the prosthetics had to, the bald cap had to be made so that I looked like a skull, and it was a long process. And I was asked initially when I was offered the role if I had any allergies to latex, and I said no, I don't, because I didn't. Until this.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Really? Yes. On the fourth day of the 5-day shoot, I woke up with my entire upper forehead where the bald cap was, and eyebrows where they, and cheeks where the prosthetics were, just in a complete hive rash.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
So I woke up that morning and I went, oh, this isn't good. And I showed up and they said, oh, what should we do? I said, put the makeup on. We have to shoot some more. Oh, but I said, I'll deal. I'll live. It's not
well, you know,
just be gentle. So I discovered I have an allergy to latex. I never had before. Yeah, as you get older, you develop allergies.
Right, we shouldn't tell anybody this because now they'll say, oh, we can't use damn.
Oh, no. But since then, I discovered the allergy completely went away. I can use any latex thing I want for as long as I want. I've tested it. It works.
So I can leave that one alone. But in regards to the makeup, when I just out of curiosity, when you are made up that heavily, do you have to spend time in a mirror? Like, does it change your facial expressions? Do you have to figure out how to make your face look the way you want it to? Or do you just do it?
It's just a great question. As you know, you're facing a mirror, obviously, when the makeup's being applied. So you're watching the transformation. And for me, and I know for a number of other actors, especially actors like me who are outside in actors, that's a big part of who you kind of become. So watching the makeup being applied with layer after layer and level after level until it gets to who you're going to be is a transformative process in its own right. And so I don't think I chose to make any actual physical choices on my face or how to use my face or how to use the makeup to make my face do certain things, but I certainly, as I was watching this transformation from Dan into Sariel, I certainly absorbed it kind of inside. I sort of took it inside, and added a weight and a depth to that character that I just I found fascinating.
Okay, so that kind of gets me to where I was going to ask. You're there in makeup. You're on the stage. The only person on the stage, the only person on camera with you for most of this. Is this woman who's kind of huddled up most of the time, right? When you're talking to her,
yeah.
And you're there, you've got this big robe, you've got these big wings, you've got all this space. I imagine
sometimes the wings.
I imagine but the hunchback and the temptation to overact, to tap into your inner Shatner would have been great, but it's also not. But it's certainly a role that calls for theatricality. How do you find the right balance for that?
That's a wonderful question. No, really, it's a wonderful question. I have, just in general, I think as an actor, I have a tendency towards theatricality. I like broad characters. I think if you've seen Patient Seven.
Plastic Wrap Man.
I do have a tendency towards large choices, big choices, theatrical choices, and it's one of the things that I wanted to kind of fight against because of the makeup and the costume. I thought, and there are certainly moments when I allow allowed that theatricality to come forth. I mean, you do not dictate choices. is not what I would call one of a more subtle moment. But then I the way Keith wrote this character, choices, the things that he allowed Serial to say and have to say, lent itself to more subtle choices, and I really, really wanted to try and do the theatricality down it.
Hey, Dan, are you like your character in real life? Oh, just kidding.
The answer is yes. The answer is absolutely yes. I usually walk around the entire house telling people, "You do not dictate choices," all the time. Say it to the little dog.
That'll work.
Oh my Lord.
So,
I do.
Have you had the opportunity to read that whole series of books?
I have read four of them. I have not read the Book of Serial, and like I said, I'm not even sure it's completed. And I haven't spoken to Keith in a little while. I do talk to him regularly. I've read the other four.
I was wondering if any of the books have the story of what Serial does after he's free.
In The Sinful Man, which is the third book, there is a hint about Serial. He's not in it.
Okay.
But he's discussed, and there's some stuff about him. And obviously, the Book of Serial is going to be all about his backstory and his history.
Oh, so all these books are connected together, then?
They're the Thanatology series. Yeah, absolutely. Okay. And they all have a similar theme. I mean, it's thematically very similar throughout all of the series. They're all about choices. Hey, my little dog is barking.
Little dog's room.
He's barking at my son. I'm going in the other room. Relax. I got it. I'm on this.
Oh, my Lord.
I was going to ask, I was going to make the comment that one of the things I found particularly interesting was the white motif, that the visual motif of white that kind of runs through the whole film.
The snow
There's the snow. Her kitchen is white.
Yeah.
Wilson's front door is white. The light, of course, is white. Were you aware of that during filming, or is that something you noticed afterward, or
only at any afterwards. Point
was, yeah, the director never shared with you that was
never,
maybe.
No. Again, as you can see, a vast majority of the film was shot at different locations. My location,
right.
All of Serial's scenes were shot in this one location. And obviously, I knew that this one location, that the light was a white light that had some color changes, but was primarily this white or this yellowish light. Art direction's a huge thing. And, they thought through this a great deal, because I agree with you. It's very clear that is an ongoing theme throughout the film.
Now, I think the white light, of course, could symbolize, or the motif of white was definitely intentional. And I do think it could symbolize any number of things. I think it depends on how you look at it. I think it could be lost. Yeah, about lost innocence. I think it could also be the light of redemption. But I also think it's maybe about casting light or bringing exposure to the darkest corners, because demon was hiding in her.
I don't mean to interrupt, but it's something that I've truly felt for a long time, and it's in the book as well. I absolutely believe it is the light of exposure. And that the demons, if you recall, when the demon eventually is destroyed, it's destroyed because it goes outside the light. And he warns Kayleen, if you walk out of that light, you're gone.
Right.
Right. That's right.
So it is absolutely, I believe it is the light of it is the light to expose the dark corners.
Well, yeah.
That's why he lurks inside of it.
Right. And what's also interesting too is that they carried it so far in that you never see her drinking red wine. She's only drinking white. Except in the beginning, you see her drinking red wine. So there's a shift there. Like, in other words, in the opening, she's drinking red wine and it's very stark against the white. So it's almost like symbolizing the staining, you know, of her life. But then later on, all the drinking you see her do is white wine. And I just thought, I don't know, that's what made me think of Exposure. I don't know why that I made that connection for some reason. It went from hiding things in darkness or in stains to bringing it out into the open.
It's either that or Marissa got tired of grape juice.
Yeah, maybe. Either one.
No, I believe it was a choice. I agree.
Dan, I have to say, when your character revealed, meaning coming out of the darkness, because you mentioned he was lurking in the darkness, and that's why it's called the lurking man, right? Even though you're really a lurking demon or fallen angel. That was an awesome reveal. And then the reveal of the wings, which we already discussed, I think was an awesome reveal as well. And it came at the right time in the film, too, because at that point, that was where the film obviously shifts. But it also, I guess, it changed the tone, I felt, movie as well, because the second half is like anarchy, chaos.
Yeah, it's a bombardment. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, especially with what happens with the sun and all these other things. So I thought that was well done and planned really good. Now, is this the first time that you've worn this much makeup for any role that you've done?
No, actually, which is why I thought I didn't have an allergy to latex. Why I discovered it had developed. When I was how old was I? In my 30s. Yeah, my 30s. So about 30 years ago. I played, what? 30 years ago. So I played Caliban in The Tempest. I don't know if you're familiar with the play.
Yeah, Willie
the Shake. Yeah, Willie the Shake. And Caliban is a monster.
Oh yeah,
he's the monster born of the witch Sycorax, and he's kind of the slave laborer to Prospero, who rules the island with his magic. And so I had extensive prosthetic makeup for Caliban, and that was a play, so I did it for, you know, weeks and weeks every day, putting on heavy prosthetic makeup, and never had a reaction. So,
huh.
Yeah, I used to give blood all the time. It was really important to me. Every time I could, I would give blood. I thought it was really important, a good thing to do for the world and for friends if they needed it. So I would give blood as often as I was allowed to. And then one time I went to a red blood drive. I gave blood. And when I got home, there was just this little rash right around the site. And I thought, oh, that's weird. The next time I went to give blood, I got a rash that ran all the way up my arm to my shoulder and neck.
Oh, wow.
So I, out of the blue, and they won't let me give blood anymore because they only use this purple betadine or iodine, whatever it is.
I said,
can't you use alcohol? And they said, no, we can't. We have strict rules.
That's weird because I remember I used to be allergic to certain kinds of tape. If they get on my skin, I would get these little rash and bumps on it. You like the heavy packing tape. But eventually, I just kind of grew out of it. It was kind of weird.
Reverse.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there it is. So I developed an allergy. But it's over now. I've like Abe. Now I put on latex makeup every day. And Dave is right. Fun.
Every day. Okay.
That's right. All casting directors. That's right. He's fine.
Yeah. He's okay. He's all right.
He just sort of like cereal to go shopping.
Yeah. It's fun. The actions you get at the store.
You might be able to get yourself some discounts that way. You do not dictate.
Just take terms. It. Take it.
That's great. So let me ask, how has the reception been to the film?
Yeah, okay, festivals and all that good stuff. Yeah,
what a lovely question.
This is what we call a softball.
It's a big softball, and I'm gonna hit it with my big bat. The reception at festivals blew me away. I have no other way of putting it. Now, as Philip wrote in his wonderful, and it was really, I thought, very well thought out and well written review of the film, that, you know, it was at these smaller festivals. It was never at a South by Southwest. It didn't go to Cannes for some reason. I don't know. Or Sundance. They told us, please come, and we said no. But it did go to these smaller festivals, and it went to which Maritza went out to many of them, some in other countries, in Germany and Italy and Spain and across the U.S., Oklahoma Bare Bones Festival and just Indiana, a lot of the feds down at San Diego Comic-Con, it wasn't San Diego. I can't remember which Comic-Con it was, but all of these different festivals, these smaller festivals, and the reception has just been nothing short of astounding. We have won. I don't have the number in front of me. I probably should have. 98 or 93.
It says 93 here. And
it might be up, but it's 93 is, and they've gone from, you know, everything from best screenplay to best film to best lead actors to best women in film to best editing to best sound to best costume. For myself, I've been honored with many best actor, best leading actor. Some people think I'm a supporting actor. I've gotten some best supporting actor awards. I think probably my favorite award that I received was from a festival called the Zed Fest, which is fairly well known out here in California. Again, a smaller one, but it's pretty well known for genre films. And Zed Fest they have their standard awards, and then they create for certain kinds of performance kind of unique awards if they feel moved to do so. And they gave me the Lon Chaney Award for acting through makeup.
Awesome.
Lon Chaney Sr. I thought that was just, to be compared to the Man of a Thousand Faces was a huge honor.
That is so cool.
Yeah,
and it's
really
probably
was.
Better than the Lon Chaney Jr. Award for Best Performance by an Alcoholic.
Yes, although, come on, Lawrence Talbot, come on.
Yeah, I've always taken offense to Mike. Because I think Lon Chaney Jr. was an awesome actor. I don't care what he says.
He was an actor.
He was awesome.
I think he was an awesome Lawrence Talbot.
Yes, he was. I think the Wolfman was a great role. And there were a couple others.
Because that was a role that fit his range. I don't think he was a particularly good Dracula.
No, terrible. But Lon Chaney Sr. Wow.
Dan, I have a question for you because I was curious since seeing the film. Maritza, what's her accent and where is she from originally?
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that. I don't know.
How do you not know that, Bill?
I think she's from Argentina, actually.
Okay.
Or Chile. Okay. One of the two. She's from a South American, South America.
Gotcha.
Spanish,
Latin. Born in Santiago, Chile.
I told you, it was one of the two.
There you go.
Now, I don't know if you would know this or not. Is her nationality, because they made a mention of it at one part that her parents barely spoke English in the script. Was that always a part of her role? Or was this just a matter of they took the best actress for the part they could and it just so happened that she was... Argentinian origin?
Chilean.
The answer to that is that this is Maritza's project. She found the project. She worked in The Cursed Man, a smaller role in the first Thanatology book turned into a movie, The Cursed Man. So she worked in that film, and that's how she met Keith, and he kind of liked her, and they got along well. And he said, "Hey, I've got this other book, Lurking Man." And she said, she read it. She said, "Ooh, I really like to produce this. I would like to play Kayleen." And so he said, "Okay, you know, we'll work out this deal, and you and I will co-write the screenplay. So I'll retain the rights to the novel, but you will have, you know, the rights with me to the screenplay, and we'll go from there." And that's so she's definitely this is her project. She produced it. Because this is a role she definitely wanted to do. And, you know, that's, to me, that's an amazing thing. It's something I have yet to find the bravery or the time, because it's a huge time suck to do. One of these days, I will probably do that. I will probably find a project that I want to do and
probably somewhat
produce it.
It costs money, obviously, too.
It's a financial commitment. Yeah. which she made. But it's also a time commitment. And she also edited the film, by the way.
Well, it says one of the trivia pieces that had DB, it says, to focus on her acting, Marta, executive producer, co-writer, editor, graphic designer, and lead actress, hired an old friend, Jen Page, to film her movie. Man, and what a slacker. She had to hire somebody else to direct it.
So what does Sariel do now? I mean, he quit his job.
That was my question. I want to know what Sariel's up to now. Is he off working in a
Cinnabon somewhere? Or?
No, he's at the local AMP.
I mean, he could certainly use some sun.
He's selling meat. He's working in the meat department.
He works at a toll booth now.
I personally believe in a serious answer to a very silly question. I believe he's his soul is allowed to move on. Paid. He's also, in my opinion, and I haven't read the Book of Sariel yet, and I haven't had a chance to talk with Keith about this, although no, for sure. I obviously, he was in a similar position to Kayleen, and he made the same choice. He chose this path of redemption, and it's a long path, as I said, a very long and horrific path. But the concept, obviously, is once you've walked that path and you find the way to pass it on, you find redemption and move on.
Gotcha.
Well, now that he's redeemed, I think when you do a sequel, you should totally get him a lightsaber. I think he's earned it.
Are you saying that because you've seen the blooper?
No, I have not.
Oh my God, that's so funny. It's something I was going to talk about. As I mentioned, you're going to love this. This is going to be a kick and a half. As I mentioned, we had some downtime on the set. And, you know, obviously when you have downtime on the set, you meant a little bit just to fill the time while they're fixing the lighting or dealing with the sound upstairs or, you know, whatever. So at one point, somebody noticed that the way I was dressed with this cloak and with this hump, that I looked like a Sith Lord.
Yep, so much.
So the lighting guys immediately got a fluorescent light, and wrapped it in the red gel, gave it to me, and started messing around like I was a Sith Lord with a lightsaber. And you can see that. There's a piece of that on the Lurking Man's website. I think she's got that. Or certainly it's one of the features of the Amazon. If you buy the Amazon, rent the Amazon, it's one of the features. But there is this lovely scene with me as a Sith Lord.
Nice.
It was hysterical. It was so much fun. Another fun thing that happened very spontaneously, because again, we're just standing around. It's just, you know, the crew and working and Jen and Maritza and Collier, the DP, and I just kind of hanging around doing nothing. And I don't know why. I don't know how it happened. I don't know what struck me. But all of a sudden, I was looking at Maritza and we were standing in the light. And I started singing Tiptoe Through the Tulips in my best Tiny Tim. And Jen just absolutely freaked out. She just freaked out. She said, "Oh my God, don't stop. Keep doing that." So there is this, and it's not on the blooper reel, sadly. I probably have it somewhere. Maritza might have it somewhere, but it is just so creepy and so wonderful.
Now, I have a question for you. What is a Sith Lord? I've never heard of this before.
Oh my God.
Oh my God.
It's a joke. It's a joke. What is the Star Wars?
Oh, Phil.
Doesn't look like anything.
Wait. I thought I made up the
I don't know. Actually, after Solo, some people might actually be asking that.
So high, Solo.
God. I was just trying to be humorous. I didn't know we would devolve into a. I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to say I've checked on Amazon because I did buy the video on Amazon. So that nickel you're getting next week is for me.
Hey, thank you.
It's they don't have the blooper.
Yeah. They don't have the blooper of the Sith Lord?
Not on Amazon.
All right. You know what, guys? I'm gonna find it. I'm going to find it, and I'm going to post it to the Facebook page.
Yes, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook page.
You betcha. I'll find Excellent. It. And I'll see if I can find the tiptoe through the tulips one, but I'll have to check with Maritza and on that, make sure that's okay.
See?
Yeah, don't
listeners,
get yourself in
you must join our Facebook group if you have not already, because you get exclusive stuff.
Exclusive, right here, right now.
And immortality.
There's also, and immortality.
Yes.
That's true.
Until you grow weary of it, and then you got to wait for a total bitch to come along and dump the job
you
on
got, you. You got to find a vessel. You got to find a fucking vessel.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass. We got deal. You know, it's always priced.
Well, I certainly want to give Dan the opportunity to plug anything he has upcoming, but I want to make sure that we've asked all the questions that we have. Does anybody have more questions for our guest?
No, I think... I think I'm all good. Everything I wanted to know was answered. So, I mean, if I didn't ask it, one of you guys ended up asking it. So my questions pretty much got answered.
All right.
And I think I've managed to cover pretty much all the points that I wanted to cover. I do want to say this before I start self-plugging. You know, it's everybody knows this. I'm not saying any great pearls of wisdom here, but a film. Making a film, especially on a very, very tight shoestring budget, is a very difficult process. It can be a lot of fun, and obviously I've told some funny stories and, you know, some great stories about the work and the process, and I love it. And I can't imagine living without it. But it is a lot of hard work, and there's a lot of people involved. There's a lot of people who do a lot of hard work and don't get the accolades and don't get the, you know, you've got Jen Page did a fabulous job directing this, Maritza producing this and putting this out, and she was wonderful to work with. She was a delight and very present when I was with her. The kids, Jensen and Tessa, were just wonderful and a pleasure to work with. Frank Krueger as Wilson. I didn't get to work with Dorian, but Frank, and I didn't work with Frank, but Frank, as the producer, was there every day and is a great guy, and I've had a lot of good conversations with him. So, and all of the crew, the people, you know, who do all the hard work, you know, lifting all the equipment, getting behind my back and lifting up my wings, and you know, hooking up lights constantly and dealing with sound. It's just Collier Landry who takes the time, who's just. Went through such physical strain to capture some of these moments with you know, the steady cams and you know, the handheld work that's, you know, really is a physical strain. And just so there's a lot of hard work and a lot of energy that goes into making even a very low budget film like this. And so everybody in that film deserves those accolades. So I definitely wanted to say that.
All right. Great.
Now I've said it.
I have found the video.
There you go. I knew it was there.
And it is now posted to the Dark Discussions Facebook
page. I already did that.
Nice.
But you won't find the tiptoe through the tulips.
Yeah, but he is going to get that for said. So we're going to hold you to that, Andy.
I'm going to check with Maritza.
He's going to see what he can do.
Okay.
Now,
here it is, serial sword play. That's awesome.
Okay, you just made Phil's life.
he looks like a Sith Lord.
What's a Sith Lord?
I don't know.
Stalker.
I did have one comment I did want to make.
Oh, please.
Yeah, just about a couple of the special effects, which I wanted to note. I really thought that at the end when she was speaking and it was the demon's voice.
Yes.
I have to give kudos to the fact for how simply rendered that was, because it was so much scarier without all that reverb and all that other junk. Like, I so appreciated that. I thought it was really scary. And in fact, I thought that when she was facing herself and it was herself as the demon and they were looking at each other, that demon face to me was one of the scariest faces I've ever seen. I thought that was really awesome.
It was really well done. It was so simple. I agree. It was so simple. And by the way, as long as we're on that note, the same I thought was true of Kayleen's, Maritza's character's makeup when she took on the mantle of death. It was only
it was hints
of what was to come, but very slight hints. And I thought the makeup job on that was terrific. And then I just thought it's so simple. I was because I just watched it again to get prepared for this, so I would, you know,
And I actually love the final shot of the film, which was of her and the way the lights turned off and her face kind of and like the colors kind of invert or like because her face like pops out of the darkness. I thought it was really. Yes.
Yeah,
really,
that was a stunning last shot. It was. Really stunning.
And it was an awesome
Lighting in the background, it fades out. Perfect closing.
I have to say, Dan, that her makeup may have been more scary than your makeup at the end.
Yeah, because it's subtle and it's a hint of what's to come. She's not decimated at this time. She's not desiccated
yet.
At this time, but it gives a hint that that's coming. You got a few millennia, and then you'll be where I was. You know, it's coming.
But you were supposed to say something.
Death angel diet.
Yes. It's the angel of death diet. It's a special diet. It's like, similar to the Santa Clarita diet. You know, you do eat people.
Except you feed on souls.
Hey, how come you guys haven't done an episode on Santa Clarita Diet? That show's amazing.
It is. It's awesome.
Somebody doesn't like comedy.
Well, it's not even that. What it is shows are usually a little more difficult to do because we have to like blow through multiple hours versus.
Very true. But what are you saying? You didn't do Jessica Jones?
Well, that's a fair.
I typically never appear on the TV series ones. I think the only one I've been able to do was Mindhunter because I just can't, like, unless I happen to be in the mood to binge something all at once.
Yeah, it's got to be a binge. I agree.
I just can't. My life is too scattered. I haven't even finished watching The Terror yet. Two more episodes to go, and I got to finish it. And I was really into it, and then the tornado hit my house, and that was it.
For the record, Dan, I have watched both seasons of Santa Clarita Diet, and I agree with you. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Have you seen their latest promotional?
I have not.
And then oh my God, my wife spotted it and took a picture. It's a bus stop. It's literally they've taken over some of those benches on bus stops and put a realty ad for the two of them, their realty company.
Oh, nice. Oh, cool.
It's only people who've seen the show are going to get it. Otherwise, you just think it's a couple of realtors. It's just wonderful.
All right, fine. I'll watch it.
Mean realtors?
I think I left out now.
Philip, you're going to love it. Trust me.
Well,
I know your taste. You're going to love it.
Drew Barrymore.
I can't. I really do want to get into it because I've heard nothing but fabulous things about it. Everybody who's seen it has said, this is awesome.
It's fabulous.
And people I respect, you know. Wait,
you mean other than me? You mean not like me? What are you saying? I thought we had a thing, Christy.
Did we just out ourselves? I don't know.
Whatever.
I will say though, I know as much as Eric likes to binge everything, Netflix just put up the new season of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and Arrested Development, and they only put up half the season.
Yeah.
The trend.
So they may be drifting away because this is like my concern whenever you have, and this is like an issue with Santa Clarita Diet and other shows on Netflix, is they drop. And if you catch it when it drops, you know, everyone's like, oh my God, have you seen Santa Clarita Diet? And then there's no reason to talk about it anymore because somebody else drops.
Right.
Something else drops. Lost in Space drops the next week. Yeah. And so I'm wondering if this is a way for them to maybe stretch out the buzz a little bit.
Could very well be.
And then maybe
they'll go back to weekly, right?
Yeah.
Now that they've done that with Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, that makes a little more sense. With Arrested Development, I know that last season they actually just had trouble
getting the cast in the same place at the same time because of the
availability. Yes, sadly for other reasons, but yes.
Yeah, so I have a feeling that, for that show it might be some of that going on, but
I think it's a deliberate strategy because they did it for both shows, and they had
it's a weird reversal.
Yeah,
well, it is, and frustrating because I love binge watching. I want to sit down and watch the whole thing all at once.
Well, I think it depends on what it is.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is about binge watching, the way I've always felt about it, I was a binge watcher way before it even existed because I would just go and buy a whole TV series on video, for God's sake, back in the 80s and watch the whole thing. But I think there is, still something to be said, and I think people are figuring this out, that there's a certain magic that happens when you have to wait. Yeah. And there's nothing more exciting to me than being like, oh my God, it's Monday night, it's 9 o'clock, whatever the hell show is going to be on. And I am just going to sit here and watch it because, and the world is going to stop. And we've lost some of that. And I think that some of these marketers are discovering that there are still people like you could buy The Terror if you got AMC Premiere and watched the whole thing all at once. And Nathan and I were like, we don't want to do that. It's more fun. We had a little appointment every Monday night, 10 o'clock, get our popcorn, sit down, watch the next episode. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah. And I think you're right. I think there is – like my son and I look forward to every Wednesday night because we can watch The Expanse together.
Another really good show.
Yeah. Oh, it's so good. It's the best sci-fi out there, in my opinion.
I got to watch that. I started watching that show, and I'm sad to admit that I've actually become a two-screener. I usually have an iPad open while I'm watching whatever. Wow. And you can't do that with The Expanse.
No, you got
to
focus.
I tried it and found myself quickly lost 10 or 15 minutes into the first episode. Yeah.
Now, you know, it's really funny, but when I started to watch The Expanse, I watched that the first episode, the pilot episode, and I went, why do I know this story? And I'm watching it go, I know this story. I had read three of the books that are the Expanse series when they were not called the Expanse series. I had just read them. Somebody recommended them. I read them and I went, these are amazing books. And so as I'm watching, I'm going, oh my God, this is the book. This is Leviathan Wakes. It's Leviathan Wakes. I'm just screaming this at my family. They're going, okay.
Now, so. Now, in terms of the way Netflix handles TV series, there's been a problem with how it's handled anime on my end. They assume that all people want to binge, so even as they don't simulcast, they don't let you watch the show as it's being aired at certain periods, so you don't get that kind of ritual of sitting down and watching a new episode comes up. You got to wait till the entire thing's ready and finished before it gets put on Netflix all at once.
Yeah. And, of course, we all get excited about, you know, Sunday nights, whether it's Westworld or Game of Thrones. I mean, that's, you know, that's an event, right?
See, I prefer binging myself.
But see, it's interesting because all I'm saying is that binging is awesome. I love binging.
Oh, too. I binge.
And I'm a total binger. But I think that there's still some magic left in the weekly. And I think, you know, Mike was saying, they're trying to drop that buzz and stretch that buzz. And they're quickly figuring out is that there was merit to people just watching it every week. There are people at work who watch Westworld. And they watch it every week or whatever. They don't. You can't. Can you even binge that? I don't know if you can.
Well, you could if you wait until
it's
over.
If you have HBO Go,
I do a podcast on it, so I have to watch it every week. My whole thing is to me the most important thing is being able to watch it on my terms. I want to watch it when I have the time to watch it without commercials. That's all I'm looking for.
And there is that. There is the commercial aspect. And that I will say that my son and I tape The Expanse.
Ah, okay.
So we watch it Wednesday night, but we don't watch it when it airs. We watch it when it's done recording so we can skip the fucking commercials.
Yeah, right. I tape for The Expanse.
And, of course, as an actor, that's probably a wrong choice because the actors make the money on commercials.
Well,
that's
you're assuming the consumers can be wrong. The only show I still the only show that I still watch live – that's on commercial networks. I'll watch Game of Thrones or Westworld live because there's no commercials. Is probably The Walking Dead because people at work want to talk about it the next day, And even then, I'll usually like pause it when it starts, go take a shower, then come back and skip the commercials that way. So I haven't watched commercials in a long time. I did write something, by the way, just shameless plug, on the Unnatural Selections blog back in 2014 that about lamenting television's new golden age for this very reason, because there are certain things like, you know, where you want to, like with Westworld, there's so much to unpack in a single episode of Westworld. Or often can be. You want to sometimes stop and think about it and ruminate about it. You want to be able to go in and share experience with somebody. I'll go back to the classic season 3 cliffhanger for Star Trek The Next Generation with The Best of Both Worlds.
Love that show. That show.
And that was something that was like, because you saw it coming and you're like, fuck, 4 months of this, of not knowing like what's going to happen to Locutus of Borg. You know, it's just incredible. Or Breaking Bad, you got like had to wait 6 months or a year to find out what happened after when Hank finally got off the crapper. You know, and there's all these, and sometimes even it's just a week to week thing. There is something to be gained from that. Think about Empire Strikes Back. Luke, I am your father, and we didn't walk out of there going, "Yep,
spoiler, Luke's
his father." No, people walked out. There was a 3-year debate over whether or not Vader was Luke Skywalker's father.
What is he really? Oh, come on. He can't be his father.
You don't even have the same last name.
Paternity test. Vader,
oh,
the
boy.
Have we gone far afield, gentlemen?
We kind of have.
It was awesome, though. It was awesome.
It was.
And we all had fun.
And
so,
I enjoyed every second. Every second. And I'm probably the guiltiest party.
So, Dan, one thing I always appreciate is I think there are a lot of very talented people out there that don't get a break because their name isn't Anthony Hopkins or Tom Hanks or, you know. And so I'm very happy when somebody like you can get out there, get in a role, even if it's in a very small film. And people should be aware this is a very low-budget film, so it's a little rough around the edges, as happens with low-budget filmmaking. But you know, and get recognized for the work they're doing. And I'm hoping it opens some doors for you. Do you have anything in the pipeline besides your day job at the law office?
My secret identity? Yeah. It's one of the things that kind of impacts my life a lot more than I wish it did. And I'm not going to change it for a little while, although, you know, I'm going to guess in a couple of years, I'll probably retire from law. But yeah, as a trial paralegal, working with the city attorney's office in police litigation, civil rights actions, I am literally in trial all the fucking time. If I'm not in trial, I'm prepping for a trial. It eats a lot of my time. I'm very fortunate. I think we mentioned this before, you may not remember, but my agent is my wife, therefore I'm fortunate in that she won't drop me. So far she has. I'm unfortunate in that most agents, by law and by rules, get 10%. My wife gets 100%. So, mm-hmm. You know, there's an up and a down. But yeah, I mean, I have turned down roles recently because I was in trial. I have turned down many auditions. I've stopped auditioning for commercials, even though that is obviously where the money is. Because I just don't have time to go out to all these places to go audition. That's a very long-winded way of saying I have absolutely nothing in the pipe right now. I've got lots of potential stuff out there. I'm very fortunate that I get to keep acting and I keep active as an actor despite the legal work. I work with the guys over at Terror Films, the distributors from Terror Film. Joe Dane, specifically and principally, holds has been holding for the last, 9 months, something like that, a screenwriters developing workshop. And I'm one of the very few and fortunate, lucky actors who gets to be there every other Saturday morning to work on these scripts and help screenwriters develop and get to work on many characters. And so definitely keeps my chops up. And there's, you know, obviously these are writers and producers and directors who are seeing my work. And, you know, I obviously definitely hope that a few of these projects are kind of, you know, have my name kind of looking at it or attached to it, maybe. So that's good. I also work with another group called FABA, Four Actors by Actors, and the same kind of thing. I work with them on screenplays and scripts, and they get to know my work. And I've worked on some really cool projects, both stage and film, with them. So, you know, there are those. I don't get much when I do audition. It's usually when I get home from trial, I, you know, put what down on tape, and I'll send the tape in. And it's not a great way to get work. I develop work. I'm developing, as I mentioned. I'm trying to work with Keith and Maritza and some other people on getting the Sinful Man into a place where I can be a part of it. There's a wonderful role that they know I want. And
so
I'm
it wouldn't be
not
it wouldn't be a stereo?
No, absolutely not. Very different role. Very, very, very different role. And it's a different story. As I mentioned, Serial is mentioned in it and talked about a little bit, but he's not in it as a character, and it is a very different story. It's the same theme, in effect. It's about morality and choices and redemptions. That's all of his Thanatology series are about, that. And about after death and where you end up after death and why, and what you choose to do with that. So that's a really good project. I'm hoping it's a great book. It's, of all of them so far, it's my favorite book. So I'm hoping that's something that happens. Your fellow writer, Gregory Norris, has indicated that he's got a couple of scripts that he's thinking about me for. He's kind of wants to send my way. So I'm waiting on that, Mr. Norris.
In the meantime, people can check out your other work. Last time I checked, Circle was still available on Netflix. Do you know if that's still the case, Dan?
Circle is available on Netflix. It is, it's hard to say words like cult phenomenon because I don't think that really applies, but it's close. And I certainly when publicizing myself, I certainly call it that. When on my resume, it's certainly called that, a cult hit. You know, uh-huh. It is very popular. Keep an eye on social media about it, and it gets a lot of interesting hits and a lot of interesting conversations, which I'm always responsive because I like to talk about it, and it's, you know, actors don't have an opportunity to talk with people who watch movies in general, so I love that about social media. So I get a chance to talk with a lot of people, and I get to see their reactions to the film, and it's great. So yes, it's still available on Netflix. If you haven't seen it, I recommend. Not just because I'm in it and I think my work is good in it, but because it's just an interesting film. It's an interesting experiment. It's an interesting concept about
psychology.
It's an
awesome film.
It's
a movie that you're going to want to watch with somebody so you can talk about it afterwards.
Oh, absolutely. And tweet about it, and I'll tweet you back.
And he's not lying, folks. I follow him on Twitter. I see him doing it, and I also see you promoting our episode on the movie, Dan, so thank you for that.
Always. I love what you guys did. Patient 7... With Michael Ironside, the horror anthology film is available on so many different VOD platforms. If you go looking for it, you can't miss it. And it's a good horror anthology. It's fun.
It's
very,
a great
very...
horror anthology.
Philip, I'm hiring you right now. You're my publicist right now. It's a great horror anthology. It's got Michael Ironside in a wonderful performance, Dan Lynch in a very dice performance. It's got a lot of really, including, you know, people, basically it's a 7 short international horror films that Terror Films, Joe Dane, the man I mentioned before in Terror Films, got the rights to, and then wrote this wraparound story that takes place in an asylum with Michael Ironside. It's a fun, good, interesting horror anthology. Great film. Great. Thank you, Philip. I've got some, you know, Shockwave, Countdown to Disaster is out there. I have a very small in that. I'm a talking head on a TV.
That's the only reason we haven't done an episode on it, because
it's an interesting film. My role is very small. It's interesting. It's okay. For considering the budget that they had to make a disaster film, it's very impressive. Mm-hmm. I'm very proud of my work in It Happened When Valentine's, if you're into romantic comedies. I have a nice small supporting role, but it's a nice role. Editor, hard-boiled editor of an entertainment rag, with a heart of gold, you know, and he's got a great character arc. I love that character, Rich, in It Happened When Valentine, starring James Maslow and Haley Webb. Lovely romantic comedy. So that's out there. So, you know, I've got some work out there that you can see if you're interested.
All right, great.
And don't forget to pick up Invocations with a foreword by Dan Lynch.
Indeed, indeed. As well as stories by a bunch of people that we know.
We know.
Well, thank you so much, Dan, for joining us tonight. We really appreciate you taking the time. And for all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in to listen to us talk about The Lurking Man with Daniel Lynch. If you haven't seen it and if you listened all this way, I can't imagine why you should have watched the movie already. But if you haven't,
great
go
film.
Do it now.
Great
go
film.
Do it right now. And we'll be back next week with another topic.
But there's nothing I could do.